Welcome to the Brad and Body Podcast. You already know who we are. We wouldn't be here, so let's not waste any more time. Here's Bradley.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Brad and Body Podcast. Hello, Botty. How are you, my man?
I'm extremely well, thank you. I'm a little disturbed by what's happening in the WNBL, but we'll get to that with their finals, the way the apparently COVID has hit Canberra, but also just the NBL round that we just saw. How good was that?
Yeah, I
reckon that was the best round I've seen in years, where just the consistency of the games was so good.
It's heating up. Playoffs are coming, but that's why this person we've got on is WNBL. And when you think of WNBL, this is the man as well. And he began his coaching career as the head coach of the Canberra Capitals in the 1989 WNBL season. And between 93 and 96, he also served as a head coach of the Perth Breakers, in which they reached a final in all four seasons, including a grand final in 93. In 95, which was one of those seasons, he was the WNBL Coach of the Year, and he also served as an assistant coach for the Australian Opals and going to two world championships as well. In 2001, he was appointed the head coach of the Cairns Taipans in the NBL, and he spent four seasons there, and he then moved on to an assistant coach with the South Dragons, where he was a member of that inaugural 2009 championship winning team. In 2012, he then coached the Australian under 17 men's team that attended the World Championships in Lithuania, and he led them, which had Dante Exum, mind you, Botty, to a silver medal. Yep. In 2013, he returned back to the WNBL as the head coach of the Melbourne Boomers, and his first season back, he was named the Coach of the Year for the second time. In 2017, he was also an assistant coach for the New Zealand Tall Ferns, and in 18 was promoted to the head coach, and he led them to a bronze medal in that Commonwealth Games. And this, in 2021, he was also appointed as the head coach for the Wellington Saints in their NBL season. He is an absolute champion, and we're so happy to have him on here. Guy Malloy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Brad. Thank you, Boddy. I'm old, mate. That's, 1989.
Yeah,
but apparently Boddy said you started coaching when you were four, so I hope that makes you feel better.
I reckon I saw you coaching at a club championship, actually, at Condell Park in Bankstown. You were coaching the Canberra women, and back when we still had the Australian Club Championship overlapping with the WNBL. I'm pretty sure.
I remember that, and I think that team, a number of the players were older than I was, so... It was throwing the deep end, and I definitely drowned.
I was actually at Bankstown on the weekend for my son's Comets game, and it was still the same, guys. It hasn't changed a bit. Guy, I want to ask you, you're a career coach, and when you think of coaching, you know, you are certainly up there, and what a great coach you are. Can we take you all the way back? Where did it start? Did it start as a player? Was it always something I'm in mind of coaching? Where did it all happen?
Oh, definitely as a player, Brad. And look, I was only ever a state league hack. I mean, I firmly knew my role, which was to distribute the ball to the American players. And I kind of got my court time because I could do that okay. But look, back in those days, one of the, I think, good rules was that for this club team was that they wanted you, if you played in the men's team, to turn around and coach one of the junior boys teams. And so... I had a bit of time on my hands, and I was actually studying coaching at the University of Canberra at the time. And that was the actual very first sports science course in Australia. And it was offered on the back of a disastrous Moscow Olympics in 1980. And if you remember, the AIS opened its doors in 1981. Yep. In 1983, the University of Canberra offered its very first bachelor degree program in coaching, and I went to the second intake in 1984. So I definitely wanted to head down the coaching path, but playing was the first love. I wasn't great at it. I was just good enough to get by and get a few minutes here and there. But then, as I said, the club turned around and wanted us to coach back in the junior program. And I think I started with the under 14s and then it went from there.
Wow. Yeah, Brad, you'd identify with that, wouldn't you? Just being a hack that got on the court and passed the ball to the Americans?
Well, I can't identify, was it? Because I was a shit coach.
So. He was a lot better hack than me, buddy.
Jeez, you must have been poor.
So what club was this at, Guy? Where were you at?
Back in those days, it was called the Ramblers Club in Canberra. And the state league was a pretty good one. The AIS competed as a team, and all the old Canberra Cannons guys, they were kind of distributed or drafted. So basically two players out of the Cannons played in every state league team. And so I think we had Dave Nelson, if you remember him.
Oh, yes, yeah, sure. Of course. Yeah.
Paul. And trying to think. I know we had a young emerging talent called John Stelzer, if you remember him at the time.
Sure. Yes, sure. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we had a pretty good front line, and but all the old Canberra Cannons greats like McGeachin played for a team, and Dufelmeyer played for a team, and yeah, you know, the AIS was in the competition, so it was a pretty handy league back then, and a lot of fun to play in, and they were the good old days
because
recovery, yeah. No sports science, play a game, have a beer and watch the next game, and
let me guess, Guy, no minutes restriction.
Absolutely, no minutes restrictions, carte blanche on the refs, because what would happen in the old National Exhibition Stadium at Canberra is that the bar was upstairs looking yes. over the championship court, so the teams yes. that played the 6 o'clock game would go up there by half time at 8:30 of the second game, they'd be fairly well tanked and offering plenty of friendly encouragement to the players and refs beneath them.
Oh, good old snake pit. Nillawarra brings back those memories as well.
So now, Guy, let's move on. You start your coaching, and you're getting to the point where they put you forward, obviously, for the Canberra women's team. And you, as you say, there were players there with a great deal of experience. But like once you got your toe in the water at that level, obviously you thought, this is something I can do.
I had a bug for it, for sure. I really enjoyed the teaching, coaching process. And I think that my brain for the game was certainly a lot better than my body for the game. Had some great mentors around Canberra at the time. Jerry Lee was the Cannons coach. A wonderful competitor, fierce defender, rebounder, great passer. And he kind of, that teamwork and great defense. I mean, they were part of the Cannons culture, I guess, at that time. And he wanted to give me that break in coaching. And I kind of, the SEABL was just starting in Canberra around that time. And I wanted to have a, you know, see if I could try out and force my way onto the end of the bench for that team and whatever else. And it was actually Jerry that sat me down and said, look, even if you made it, which is probably not going to happen, that would be it. I mean, that would be as far as you could possibly get playing. But we think that you've got a bit of a brain for coaching. So there's an opportunity to go early and fast track you with WNBL.
Right.
And look, he was pretty influential to push me into that role. As I said, I think that I sunk and drowned more than I coached well, because I was 24 maybe at the time. And yeah, look, a lot of the players, Jenny Cheeseman, who actually body I saw in Adelaide last weekend. It was just great to see her. I mean, you know, she was the Australian captain back then before they were even called the Opals. So that ilk of player and some others. And, you know, they knew a lot more about the game at the time than I certainly did. So I think that they went and competed through the year and did okay despite me as much as anything else.
Did they give you a hard time, Guy? Because they seem to be the sort of players that would have been trying to embrace you and help you along the journey, as opposed to just, oh, what's this kid know sort of thing. You know, would Jenny and people, I'm assuming they were helpful in your career.
Jenny was very, very patient and very helpful. And one of the things that I had done in preparing for that year is that I took myself off to the States, as all young coaches do at that time, and tried to get a little bit of a feel for what, you know, the true tradition, legacy, history of coaching is about. And my one choice of, well, the two coaches I went to see were Bobby Knight and Dean Smith. And probably my choice of seeing Bobby Knight wasn't behaviorally the best choice.
You just like him, Guy. I see you throwing chairs all the time.
Well, he operated from that mantra of fear. Yeah. I mean, behind that, it was a wonderful basketball brain. But sure. I think that what it taught me is that I've got to come in and really put my foot down and you know, my way is the highway or the highway kind of approach to it. And I probably should have taken a bit more notice of Dean Smith, who was completely opposite. And I mean, these were the two biggest coaching megastars in the States.
Absolutely.
At the time. And yeah. I was really blessed to get the access that I did. And I've got a great memory of being invited into a post-game North Carolina meeting. So Dean Smith's running the meeting. He's sitting there. He's got Roy Williams on one side of him and Bill Guthridge on the other side of him. And I'm sitting in a line of four chairs while they're watching the TV and the old VCR, furiously trying to scribble as many notes as I can. And I think that every American person that I know, when I relay that story to them, they just don't believe me. It's yeah. like, well, it would be like getting in to see the Queen. It's just not yeah. going to happen. And even when I think about it now, it's like, well, just how did that ever occur? But so anyway, I had these experiences and I took them back. The players such as Jenny Cheeseman, Linda Smith, others, they were very patient with me as I sort of stumbled along and tried to find out what my philosophy to coaching was. And I don't think that at that age that you're kind of able to always communicate it too effectively. But look, we did what we did, and we had a reasonably successful season. We didn't make the playoffs, but I think that the team competed quite well. And then after that, memory serves me, it was not long after that that I went into the SEABL coaching with the Canberra Gunners as well. And that was probably a little bit more suited to me at the time with coaching the males rather than the females. And that is one question I've had a lot through my career, because I've coached men and women and have yeah. tended to flip-flop back between both. And so that was an early taste of that as well for me.
That was certainly a question that I had. So let's go straight there anyway. I don't want to say what's easier, because there is no easy path in coaching. What do you find the biggest challenge between both?
The biggest challenge is that the girls are generally, and this is a gross generalization, obviously, I believe they're bigger internalizers and self-critics and self-doubters. And I reckon that their confidence, when it goes, it can really crash, and it can be harder to bring them back out of that. In general, again, I reckon that the guys don't have as many big confidence swings as what the girls do, and probably a bit more belief in their own ability to back things up. So that would be, I think your message has got to be carefully tended to in that way. I reckon, you know, if you've got some bad news to deliver to one of the lads that you're coaching, you can reasonably expect that they might bounce back a little bit quicker, a bit faster, a bit higher. Whereas I think that with the girls over the years, I've found that you've got to be a bit more tactical about that.
Yeah. Yep.
And having said that, though, definitely coaching the women, if you've got a committed, on the same page group, they are in many respects as fierce or even more fierce about their buy-in and cause and connectivity to the team and doing the right things by the team. So I think that that's probably their strength, which in many respects outweighs the men.
Good answer there. So you've spent a number of years now in Perth, and obviously I'd love to hear how and you know the coaching for Cairns came up. What was that decision? Yes, this is the path I want to go down now, or was it something that was always an itch you wanted to scratch?
I was really concerned after my 4 years coaching in Perth that I would be labelled as a women's basketball coach and not a basketball coach.
Right.
And the financial opportunities were very, very limited, to, as they still are in many respects, with coaching females. So I had a chance to connect with Brian Gorgian for the first time as an assistant with the Southeast Melbourne Magic back in the early boom days of the NBL, like that mid-90s. I think 97, I may have joined them. So, look, I jumped at that chance, and Brian's been one of the most wonderful mentors in my life and career. And
totally.
I spent four wonderful years with him. Unfortunately, we also lost four grand finals in a row, so it was you know, some pain and pleasure. But I think when we got to the end of that, and by this time we'd switched to become the Victoria Titans. I reckon by the end of my second year with the Victoria Titans, I had a couple of good offers on the table, of which Cairns was one, and went through that with Brian a lot, and decided to you know, take up that first NBL head coaching opportunity with Cairns. And so, you know, it was a difficult road ahead after that, but the timing was right to certainly go and do it.
I don't want to make this feel any worse, but just as you were bringing up those four grand final losses, I've got a video straight on Botty, and the smile on his face, mate, he's just got Adelaide 36ers written all over it. So I just wanted to let you know, there was no, he felt sorry for you at all. I did, Guy. I feel for you. But him, nah, nothing.
No, not in that instance. Yeah. That was a golden era. That was that particular rivalry. I mean, whether it boiled down to Adelaide and South East Melbourne or Phil and Brian, Phil Smythe and Brian Gorgian, it doesn't really matter. I just thought that was an absolute golden period in the game.
Well, it was wonderful. I mean, walking out any game that you had at Rod Laver Arena back then with 15,000 people, you know, Tigers, Magic, Adelaide, Titans, whatever they were. I mean, they were just fierce and wonderful games. And I think that because Brian was so much of the American basketball school, and I was learning through that school, and it's not just Brian, because you've got to understand the coaching tree around and behind him is Mike Dunlap, Ed Gorgian, Jerry Tarkanian, Tim Gergovich. I mean, deep roots into the NBA and that real hardcore American style. And it became like a boxing game, a battle of styles, because on the other hand, Lindsay at Melbourne Tigers, and Lindsay's another wonderful part of my story. And Phil was very much, I think, in the Lindsay school of how game coached and prepared. So it was a great battle of styles. And then the players obviously embraced the styles of the coaches. And it was a golden time for sure.
Yeah, and I think today they've completely overlooked that era. When I'm listening to some of the TV commentary on games today, it's as though basketball or the NBL started 5 minutes ago, and they forget that 25 years ago, 30 years ago, we are laying the foundation for the league as it is now. There was some great basketball being played. So you've gone up to Cairns, and obviously you're working on your tan for 4 years. how did that come to what were the highs of that, and how did that come to an end?
Well, I went in on the back of 1 year in the league. So the team's inaugural year, they went 2-26 and fired their coach.
Right.
And that probably gives you an indication.
Yes.
So it had to be built to the heights of where, say, Fernie got it to with successive grand finals and that kind of thing. So 2-26, nowhere near the salary cap. I think back in those days, the NBL salary cap was around the $1 million mark. I was told, well, look, you know, the club can spend a $700,000, maybe that kind of mark. You get there, where are the basketballs? Have we got any video machines? That kind of thing. That's where you're starting from. And it's no criticism of that. It was just a club that was trying to, it was in a geographically isolated small town market trying to get there. And these were all the teething issues and problems that came with it. Over 4 years, we built that, and I can remember the numbers because I had to kind of justify it in so many respects. But so they won two games in their first year. Second year, it was 6, then 9, then 12, then 17. And I'm just saying that as a – and we got to the second round of the playoffs, and West Sydney Razorbacks knocked us out. And my fifth year there – when we rebuilt it, we dropped back to 12 wins. We introduced a number of young guys to the club, and the writing was on the wall, and I got fired and I was out of there. So it was the brutal reality of coaching. But I'm not saying any of that to say, well, what we did was great or anything like that at all. It was just the necessary steps that the club had to go through to become a force in the NBL. And when you are subpar to the cap, And in those days, it was Macquarie Bank with the Sydney Kings. It was Eddie Groves with the Brisbane Bullets, that kind of market at the top end of the league. If you're not at the cap, you've got to fight and grind for everything that you can possibly get. So I look back at it as a young head coach. I did lots of things I wouldn't do next time around. At the same time, I'm not unproud of how it emerged and what happened. But it was tough, and they made a move to go in a new direction under new ownership, and they probably enjoyed a couple of years after that built on that platform.
Okay, now I saw you coaching Victoria Metro, I reckon, under 18 in Launceston, winning the championship there. I'm pretty sure that was you guys. I'm testing my memory. Would that be right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so look, I was pretty burned out after the 5 years, I've got to say. It was tough going in Cairns. And then when we moved back to Melbourne, there was a fella called Ross Wignall, who was the director of coaching at Basketball Victoria at the time. And he said, well, look, at the under 18 level, Vic Metro, who are normally an absolute powerhouse, I think they had a couple of seventh place results or something like that. So he said, look, can we appoint you to coach the program? Because I think that, you know, we've got to clearly do better. And I wasn't sure. I mean, I was pretty rock bottom, particularly after getting that first firing, which is a real come up and steady coach.
Sure.
But it turned out to be a great thing. So I did that for 3 years. We got them back to the top. They won 3 gold medals. And then on the back of that, I got appointed to coach the Australian 17 and under team, because FIBA had removed the 21 and under age group. And I had been the head coach of the 21 and under age group. Too many of those guys were going into the draft and pro leagues and that kind of thing. So FIBA got rid of it and introduced the level beneath the U19. So they went with the U17s. And on the back of the Victorian Metro stuff, I got appointed to coach the Australian stuff. And look, I was blessed by all that. It was just great timing, because it was all the crap associated with NBL was not there. I could just go back and be a basketball coach for 95% of it. And I absolutely loved it. And to see a bunch of kids on their way through, such as Exum and a bunch in the NBL and others, you know, it was perfect for me at the time.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, in basketball, when you just get to that point where you're no longer happy in the sport. There's whatever's happened, whether you've been sacked or whether you're just in an environment that was uncomfortable or whatever. Get involved with kids again, and it just kind of re-sparks that fire within you. It's an amazing thing. And so I'm presuming from this is where you then move on into Bulleen and it becomes Melbourne, that's the next sort of step in the journey?
Well, actually, I went to the South Dragons.
Of course.
Yeah, they'd had their inaugural year and Mark Price had been the head coach, and then they had a bit of a revolution from within, and Shane Hill was a playing coach. Mark Cowan and Shane asked me to come back into that program and work as essentially the bench coach, but then to conduct practice sessions and prepare the team. And so that went okay for a year, and then the second year it didn't quite go so well, probably with that sort of coaching arrangement. And it was just, you know, I think difficult, probably, you know, the last stages of a playing coach perhaps working well in the NBL, like just too much divided responsibility or too much divided attention. And, you know, the club parted ways with Shane. A lot of people moved on. I was one that was able to stick and stay. And then Brian got brought back into the program. And that was, you know, beautiful for me to have that reconnection with him when he came back from Asia. And we had 1 year together and were able to win the championship this time. And then the damn club folded, Boddy. So I had to go home one Friday afternoon and tell the wife, well, we're out of a job again.
Yeah, wow. Career coach, eh? Isn't it? Oh, God, man, it just doesn't end.
It's a tough thing, but so now you get to Bulleen and Melbourne, because I want to get to that, because, you know, you've enjoyed quite considerable success, and now your team is in the grand final, this season's grand final. You've got there, you know, very strongly the first game against Adelaide, game one of the best of three semi-finals, was an extraordinary match by anybody's calculations. That first half, you know, you're 15 down, you win by 31. It's just and scored 95 points and 60, I think it's 63-17 in the second half. Like, it was just an unbelievable performance, really hard to describe. Then you come in for game two, and really, I didn't really expect much from Adelaide, and I thought they gave you a decent game, but you know, you were the better team, and we're always going to be. And so now you're in the championship, and this comes at a time, Guy, where you already announced at the start of the season that you wouldn't be continuing after the season. So walk us through what's the opportunity that you're taking up in New Zealand, and how exciting is this? Maybe finishing on a championship.
It's all been pretty complicated, and given all the COVID and fixture protocols and whatever else that's going around right now, I'm glad that the decision was made at the start of the year that I was going to make this one my last one. I'd been in a dual role, and coaching women's basketball, you've really got to hustle. Like, it's not enough to have one job. So I've been the New Zealand national team head coach for 4 years.
Yep.
And the Boomers head coach. So to make it all work financially, I've needed both. When the Federation in New Zealand got to the end of their funding cycle, they were able to get more money off the government. And for Perro Cameron and myself, Perro's the Tall Blacks head coach, they turned those positions into what you could probably best describe as like 70 or 80% full-time jobs.
Right.
Fortunately for me, they were willing to keep me on in that position, but they were really serious about making the move to New Zealand. They understood that the position, my personal belief is you just can't be the national team head coach and coach in one or two tournaments a year, but you need to continue to sharpen and develop skills. So I said, well, look, I need to be coaching in an elite league. This was part of the negotiation, and they countered with, well, that's fine, but you need to be coaching in the league in New Zealand. And after that, it was, I had had a couple of clubs from New Zealand that had talked to me and about the possibility. And but then thankfully was able to connect with, you know, without doubt, the greatest, most successful club in the New Zealand NBL, which is the Wellington Saints. So it was kind of, but one wasn't reliant on the other necessarily. They both happened independently, and then together I had a package, and that kind of worked. So when we got to that point that I had offers on the table, then I went back to the Melbourne Boomers with that, because I was definitely out of contract by the end of the year. And so when I went back, it was like, well, they were certain that they wanted me to stay around, but I was probably emotionally, after 9 years, really just ready to make a change. And the Boomers have been wonderful, wonderful people, just a wonderful club. And it was really tough to make the decision to go. But that's how it came about. And then, of course, we go into this COVID year, which I really reckon of any of the whatever I've had, 35 years or something in coaching, that this has been the most complicated year to coach from an emotional, psychological sort of standpoint. We're just faced with this situation now of delays and postponements and whatever else again with COVID. Yes. And so I'm really not sure how it's going to pan out in the next few days.
Yeah, well, I'm for the benefit of the listeners who don't know, the rival best of three semi-final between Perth and Canberra has now been reduced to a two-game series because of a COVID situation that exists within the Capitals. And I think it's the second game, so it's not going to be a best of three, it's just a two-game series, which Brad and I will probably talk about after we've finished the interview, Guy, but we don't think that's kind of right. But that's set everything back, because the next semi-final won't be for a while, and then the grand finals won't be starting till about the second week of April, by which time you have commitments now in New Zealand. You've got WNBA players that are going to be heading back. You've got Australian players that are going to want to try out for WNBA teams. It's a diabolical situation right now.
Yeah, very complicated. And, look, my personal opinion is that they may need to just call on the semi-final series to make it work, because the other factor, if you think that a grand final series, three games can be held over the space of maybe a week max, maybe even less than that, where you've got travel to and from Perth, say,
yes,
and Melbourne. I mean, it's just not possible because to travel to and from Perth, you need a day's recovery either side of that, let alone playing in a grand final game. So if it goes to three games, I'm just not really quite sure how that would work. So I don't know that I have all the answers, Boddy, but the other things are, as you said, there's WNBA players in the Melbourne and Perth rosters. Now they're being required to report back to training camps. That's going to happen really soon. Those players start getting fined if they can't report back to camp.
Yes.
Yeah, look, there's a window by which the league's got to finish, but my personal opinion is that they've got to give the grand final series priority and probably not the semi-final series.
Absolutely. But they have to come out with it straight away. I think they've got to make a decision. Okay, it's going to be a one-off grand final. Melbourne finished top. It's going to be in Melbourne. And that's all there is to it. You can't have a best of three semi-final series and then the other semi-final series starts now. No, that's going to be best of two now. We're going to change that, which means the margin in the first game becomes far more pertinent, which a Perth might, instead of winning by 14, they might be trying to win by 20, 25. Maybe you don't clear your bench, all that sort of thing. The decisions that BA and the WNBL have made just boggle my mind. But I don't want to get you in the poo. let's just leave me with
a
mind goggle.
Let me jump in then. Let's talk about some people. Exactly. We'll let Guy get off. But Guy, look, at this time of the stage, we could ask a number of questions, and maybe we'll get you back on after the season. But let's what we do at this time of the pod is we just ask you a one word or one sentence answer about the person that we're about to say to you. So we'll give you a name, and just the first thing that pops into your mind. I'm going to start with the GOAT, Brian Gorshin.
Inspirational.
Good. Okay. I've got Dewey Michaels.
Dewey Michaels. I get one word. Very, very complex. A hyphenated word. Fun loving.
Okay.
Nice. I like that. Okay. I'm going to go next. Timsy. Michelle Timms.
I'll give you another hyphenated word, the flag bearer. I just think she started so much for so many female players.
Great analogy.
In Australia.
Great analogy. Yeah.
All right. I've got Kayla George.
Comparative name. Jokic. To me, she's my Jokic. She's such a great passer. And she can really shoot the ball. Like she's a prototypical point forward, point center. So I'd have a laugh with her and say, you're my Jokic.
Nice. I'm going to a former teammate of mine, and I know he came up there to you in Cairns, Aaron Trehair.
Talent.
Yeah.
Trehair, Brad, was one of those guys that for an Aussie, there weren't many that, if he was really in the mood, could come in and drop 40 on a team. I mean, how many Aussies have been around that can do that? Trehair was, and look, we all know with Azza that maybe he wasn't thinking that way or going to play that hard, but if his mind was set on it, he's one guy that had the talent.
Look, he was a great mate of mine, and I had some times when he went through training, he wouldn't miss a shot. We're talking 3 hours. That guy would just – I remember when Kelsey Weems came out and he guarded Aaron that guy, one first training, and he just did not miss a shot. And it was like Copes' story with
Dean Vickerman.
Yeah, Dean Vickerman. And he's like, mate, like this guy's unbelievable. And he is. You're right, Guy. He just could turn it on whenever he wanted.
Well, he had such strong wrists. Like he could shoot his free throw shot from behind halfway. I always remember that with him. Like the form was exactly the same.
Yeah.
And he was one of those guys like Frank Drimmick, Andrew Gaze, at the under 14 level, was clearly going to be a superstar. You could see it back then. He was one of those generational junior players.
Yep.
All right, we've got one to go, and this is also someone I'm hugely fond of because I thought she did some things in the game, the second semi-final against Adelaide for you, where she just had what I call Bryce Cotton moments, where it was just time to take control, make a big shot. I'm talking about Lindsay Allen.
In one word, I would just say, I would say the best in one word, Boddy, because I just believe she's the best point guard in the league. And she has a different role in the WNBA, but coming to the WNBL, I can really have her score. And I think she just goes to another level.
Yeah.
She's great awesome. Answer. Guy, mate, thank you so much for coming on this pod. We say it every week as well. We could be talking for hours. It's you are a maestro of a brain of the NBL and WNBL, and you're huge for the league, and what you've done is fantastic. So we wish you all the best
for the championship,
absolutely, and obviously for New Zealand. And thank you so much for coming on. I'm sure we'll speak soon. Well, that was fun, buddy. Perfect timing to have Guy Malloy on with what's going on in the WNBL, and obviously we wish him all the best.
I would really love to see him finish on a championship note.
Yeah, I agree.
In the WNBL, and then move on to his new role, where he'd be one of the rare people who's been involved with the Opals, the Boomers, and the Tall Ferns.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Good one. Well, let's talk NBL. What a weekend of games.
That was the best round, I reckon, I can remember. Regular season round, that was as good as I've seen in 20 years, I reckon.
Well, pretty much. I mean, obviously, Perth going down to Jack Jumpers, that was wow. You know, that was a close game.
Yes.
Then Brisbane going down to Jack Jumpers. What about this Tasmanian team?
Yeah. Do we start taking them serious? Come on, I know they're taking them serious. They're 12-10. If we're talking Southeast Melbourne can make it at 12-10, why can't we start to include Tasmania in the conversation?
I mean, it's a great – if you would have said to me at the beginning of the season, Tasmania are going to be equal wins with Southeast Melbourne, like, what are you smoking?
Yes, exactly. Right. And I would have been smoking something.
I should say, what else are you smoking, right? So, but it's like unbelievable. So, look, we've been saying it all year. Like, it's a tick for them. They've just done everything right. I'm sorry, I still can't see it. You know, I've been saying that for the whole year.
Yeah.
Don't think Phoenix will make it. I don't think the Jack Jumpers. But
I think Illawarra last game where they beat the Jack Jumpers in Launceston. I think that was a statement that no. The four is going to be.
But I also
Melbourne
think
Perth,
beating that Phoenix as well. Beating that Phoenix, I just took the air out of them when Illawarra beat them last week. But, you know, I look at that. Tasmania 12 wins, Brisbane 8. This is a real underperforming Brisbane Bullets team, mate.
Absolutely. They are the under. It's a toss-up. As again, I always leave New Zealand out of this because I think their circumstances are such that you can't be overly critical. But Brisbane, they are the underachievers, and maybe Cairns as well, because Cairns at full strength should be doing better than what they are. But Brisbane, 8 wins, and some of the ways they've found to lose, and one of the ways they found to win, have been pretty extraordinary.
Well, what stood out for you on the weekend, though?
What stood out for me was the very first game. You know, for Brisbane to score the amount of seven down, 24 seconds to go to win that game. This is already in overtime to win that game. That was as phenomenal a finish as I've seen. And, you know, we've been around a long time, Brad. We've seen a lot of, you know, game winning shots happen over the years that they happen. It's not like that's a rarity and we should just, you know, throw our skirts in the air and go, ooh, someone shot a winner. But that unfolded was pretty bloody amazing.
It
really
was. But I tell you, the team, the Kings, whoa. That's a statement. Kings. Perth, isn't it? Yeah. Jalen Adams. Wow.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But, I mean, the way they shot in that first quarter, 35-14, it's like the game was over. The game was definitely over by halftime when they're 25 up.
Totally.
But it was pretty much and it's an interesting situation, though, because now Sydney have won, 9 games straight, and this was probably, in that 9 games, this was probably the first one where I've sort of thought, okay, they're legit. I'm slow to jump on. You know that. I'm slow to jump on. I like to sort of just
Well, you're slow to jump on, and then you're a dinosaur to get onto the Kings. So I'm with you, mate. So I know what you're saying. For you to get onto the Kings, mate, it's got to be huge.
Yeah, I think there's enough there. I think there's enough there to win a championship, because any one of these teams, like Perth at its best, Melbourne at its best, Sydney at its best, and now Illawarra at its best, any one of those could win the championship at their best. But it's one of the others prevents them from being at their best, and that's how it works out. So I think we've got four teams that are legit in the conversation. Right now, Perth is the one that you've got a little bit of a question mark over.
Yep.
But 2 weeks ago when they won three games in a row on the road and beat United in that group, we were thinking they're fine.
You were then saying question marks and Illawarra.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So you're right.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Do you see the top four changing?
No, I do not. No. I really don't.
Okay. Maybe the positioning, but not the top four.
Yeah, yeah. The way they were structured, it may well alter.
Give me a nasty.
Okay. Give me a nasty. Right. Well, this one is directed at NBL coaches generally, but Scott Morrison particularly. Like, Scott Morrison lost his mind at a particular question about John Brown at the press conference after they'd been beaten by Tasmania. Now, I understand he's come into that press conference. He's already agitated because they've lost a game that they would have absolutely have penciled in as a win. So he's not in a good frame of mind. Then he loses his cool, and he really did lose it, at a reporter asking a question about John Brown. Well, look, here's a clue. Here's a clue for you and every other NBL coach. As a person who worked in the media for more than four decades, just tell the truth. How about that? Just try that. Tell the truth. The first time you're asked the question, give an honest answer. Don't give a bloody grey, faded, bullshit answer and then wonder why you're getting the question again. You're going to keep getting the question until you give an answer. All right? So give an answer that's as honest as you can be the first time, and then everybody moves on. Then you don't get to this point, okay? So that's one for Scott Morrison. I mean, I look at a person like Dean Vickerman. This would never happen with a Dean Vickerman. That wouldn't happen with a Gorge. I don't even think it would happen with a Dan Shamir, James. There's a lot of coaches that already understand. Just be forthright. Now, I also understand that maybe they don't want to be forthright with some journalists because there's a high turnover rate of the people writing about the game, and so you maybe don't develop the trust that we used to be able to develop over time.
Yes.
But I'm just saying, if you're honest, as honest as you can be at the time of the circumstance, and give an honest answer, they will leave you alone and move on. That's me. Give us something better. Give us something more. Rose and Rattler, come on, give us something.
Yeah, to me, I'm just still in a bit of a shock that a team like a Perth and a Southeast Melbourne aren't prepared. Now, I'm going back to last weekend as well, and I'm like, to know that, like, you use Southeast Melbourne, they came into that weekend where it's like, right, we got two massive games, and one of them you could call a double body, as we know, beating playing Illawarra, right? Yep. You go up one and push them down. And they just didn't, like, come out wanting the ball. And then I look at Perth, excuse me, mate, they didn't give a shit on Saturday night, right?
Against now, Sydney Sydney specifically?
No, I'm talking Sydney game specifically.
Okay.
Now, right. Obviously they care. I'm not suggesting, but what I'm saying is they just look like, well, this one's not going to come out and blah, blah. I just can't believe that teams aren't thinking, hang on, we need top spot.
Yeah.
We want to get as high as we can because we do not want to be going on the road and blah, blah. Now, Sydney, they came in knowing, number one, we're going to take you down because everyone's saying that the championship leads through Perth. Everyone's saying now that you're doing it and blah, blah. I'm just shocked to watch a Perth and Southeast come out and not play with the energy that I thought they would for playoff. Illawarra have, Sydney have, and you've got to give them credit, right? And Tasmania are.
Yes.
So why are those teams doing it?
Southeast Melbourne are erratic, but they've got a couple of players missing. I mean, everyone has had players missing, so it's not really an excuse. What I'm saying is you can't get this kind of disparity in form. Like, a Brandon Ashley goes for 26 points and dominates in Cairns, and then gets 4,000 for 4 points in the game against Adelaide. I mean, the guy's got a lot of bad habits.
You've been waiting about 40 minutes to do that one, haven't you?
No, but my point is...
No, you're right.
You can't have that variety of performance, and he's got to be better than that, than to get into foul trouble against a team that's got, you know, no legit bigs with Isaac Humphries out. Cam Bairstow wasn't playing. Like, he could have been the most dominant player in the game instead he's riding the pine. I just reckon that kind of stuff is a little weak.
And players have got to know better. They need you. Yep. They need you out in the court. You're no use. Boddy, thank you, mate. I want to thank everyone to Piranha Media and, of course, our huge sponsors, Burger Boss. We love those burgers and hot dogs as well, Boddy. Look forward to it, mate. You have a fantastic week, mate.
You too. Looking forward to this round. See if it can be half as good as the last one. It'll be pretty good if it is.
Absolutely. To everyone else, enjoy watching the basketball and we'll see you next week. Mate, you brought up about that Perth Brisbane game.
Yeah.
William McGough White showing
what
that.
Is it? What are you thinking, mate? Yes. Like, all I can think of, with 1.5 seconds, you just got to get it in. Just
did you see how Abercrombie was wide open?
Wide open. Throw? You're wide open and just throwing the ball. You just got to hold it. Like, I don't know how many people know that the clock starts when it touches somebody.
Yeah.
So he's just got to get it in and hold it. But he's trying to throw it the length of the floor and hoping for a prayer. I don't know what the hell happened there. But
he won't sleep for a week.
And nor should he.